Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the stealth attempt by House Republicans to get rid of the Office of Congressional Ethics as their first priority that backfired, igniting a firestorm of protest which prompted Donald Trump to tweet out a message to them to back down in the name of draining the swamp, which they did. Noah Bookbinder, the executive director of CREW, Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, joins us to discuss the about-face reversal of a secret vote of 119-74 by House Republicans to strip the independent Office of Congressional Ethics of its powers on day one of the new Congress that was quickly dropped from the rules package of measures the next day due to public outcry, which allowed Donald Trump to take credit, while House Republicans ended up looking corrupt and weak. Then we will explore the irony that President Erdogan's Islamist government in Turkey encourages religious and nationalist hate mongers while jailing a prominent journalist for predicting weeks ago that Islamists might target New Year's celebrations. Natanya de Longbas, a professor of theology at Boston College, who researches modern and contemporary Islamic thought and practice, joins us to discuss whether Erdogan is trying to create his own Islamic State in Turkey, while the terrorists of the Islamic State in Syria that he previously enabled are now attacking him for turning on them and allying with Russia. Then finally, we will speak with Daniel Rogers, Professor Emeritus of History at Princeton University, whose recent book, Age of Fracture, won the 2012 Bancroft Prize. He has an article at The Guardian, Liberals Risk Becoming a Permanent Minority in America, and we will discuss how anger overrode optimism in the recent election and the need for liberals to find new means of talking truth to Americans and making sure they hear them, while a populist billionaire spins fairy tales and trickle-down fantasies about freeing up the billionaires to make America great again. And joining us now is Noah Bookbinder, who's the executive director of CREW, Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington. Previously, he served as director of the Office of Legislative and Public Affairs at the United States Sentencing Commission and as chief counsel for criminal justice for the United States Senate Judiciary Committee, where he advised Judiciary Committee Chairman Patrick Leahy on government oversight matters. Welcome to Background Briefing, Noah Bookbinder.
Great to be here.
And what do you make of this to and fro with a stealth attempt by House Republicans meeting in secret to strip the power of the Office of Congressional Ethics? It immediately created a firestorm with Nancy Pelosi and others stepping forth and pointing out how extraordinary it is that the first act of this new Congress would be to attack ethics in a kind of stealth way. But the stealth part's certainly gone away. But what's happened since now seems to be that Donald Trump is sort of, in effect, taking credit. He tweeted, with all that Congress has to work on, do they really have to make the weakening of the independent ethics watchdog as unfair as it is? Maybe their number one act and priority, focus on tax reform, health care, and so many other things of far greater importance. And then, of course, the hashtag DTS, drain the swamp. So what do you make of it?
Well, first of all, it was sort of an astonishing initial thing for House Republicans to do when they opened up this new Congress. For years and years, there was really little oversight or meaningful action to ensure any kind of ethics in Congress because members essentially looked out for each other. It was nobody had an incentive to be tough on other members because they were worried about what could happen to them. The Office of Congressional Ethics was really one of the first bodies that could be effective in ensuring some accountability for ethics problems with Congress. So particularly after an election season where clearly the public was so unhappy with business as usual in Washington, for the House to come in and think that it made sense for the first thing they did to be weakening the one body that provided effective ethics oversight seems kind of crazy. So I think what happened is when they came in and they did that, and I think hoped they could do it quietly and nobody would notice, people did notice and people were outraged and there was this outpouring of public outrage. My sense is that President-elect Trump sensed that, saw that there was widespread public outrage, and because of that, and because it wasn't an issue that affected him greatly, and he's been under fire for various ethics issues, it felt like it wasn't a hard call for him to then come out and distance himself. I think it gives him a little too much credit to say he, in any sense, strongly opposed it. He kind of said, you know, this might be an okay thing to do, but it shouldn't be the first thing out of the gate. But it was enough, I think, for to send the signal to House members who are already feeling a lot of public outrage that there wasn't a lot of support for what they were doing.
Well, in the meeting itself, when they decided to strip the Independent Ethics Office of its powers, there was a pushback from House Speaker Paul Ryan and the House Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy. I don't know what the basis of their objection was, but they're certainly being proven correct, right?
I think that's right, and I don't know, obviously, what was said inside that closed-door meeting. I suspect it was along the lines of, this isn't going to look very good if we do this first thing out of the gate. And to the extent that that's what they said, it was proven right. And so I think it was really just a misreading of the mood of the country and the sort of the values of the country, that people really do care about an ethical government and were shocked at an effort to do what looked like and I think would have been watering down what is already probably insufficient accountability on ethics questions.
And again, I'm speaking with Noah Bookbinder, who's the executive director of CREW, Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington. Previously, he served as director of the Office of Legislative and Public Affairs at the United States Sentencing Commission and as chief counsel for criminal justice for the United States Senate Judiciary Committee. So what do you think, then, Donald Trump meant in his tweet where he said that, with all that Congress has to work on, do they really have to make the weakening of the Independent Ethics Watchdog as unfair as it is? Now, apparently, it was this effort to get rid of the Office of Congressional Ethics was led by Representative Goodlatte of Virginia, but clearly he had the majority of the House Republicans behind him. What is it? I mean, without assuming that somehow these guys don't want their hands tied and want to indulge in as much corruption as they can possibly get their hands on, that's the sort of impression that they give. But what is their justification for it that doesn't look like they're basically wanting a free hand to indulge in corruption?
I think they've argued that this office was overzealous, that it acted on anonymous complaints, which might have been politically motivated, and that it might have exposed members of Congress to criticism for possible ethics violation, even if ultimately no violation was proved. I think that as we look at it, their criticisms are not terribly persuasive. It actually makes sense to be able to look at anonymous complaints. That's what there are a lot of offices within the government that do that because sometimes people worry about retaliation, or they're only willing to come forward with serious and legitimate charges if they're anonymous. Our sense has been that the Office of Congressional Ethics doesn't act rashly; that it really does look into complaints to see if there's anything there before moving ahead. You know, look, sometimes they will investigate something and nothing will turn up. And sometimes if that becomes public, that can be difficult for somebody. That's true of all kinds of investigations. We've seen countless examples of people who were listed as the subject of an investigation, whether by police or the FBI or whoever, who were ultimately exonerated, and that's never pleasant. But that's not a reason to to strip an independent body of its independence and its power. And I think what this really comes down to is, you know, nobody wants to be investigated. It's not a good thing. It's not a fun thing to go through, particularly if you're engaging in conduct that might be borderline at best. And so they'd rather not do it. But that's not a legitimate reason to make these changes.
Well, but the ethics office itself came into being because of the extraordinary activities of the former lobbyist Jack Abramoff and the number of congressmen that were just, you know, literally swilling at the trough of corruption that he had laid out for them. And he, of course, did a whole sort of come to Jesus and laid it all out and exposed so much of the corruption that he benefited from. And some of it was pretty ugly. I recall, you know, tapes of them laughing about taking advantage of Native American tribes, and etc. So it was definitely a period of exposing the really corrupt underbelly of Washington, and this office was brought in to sort of clean up Dodge, if you will. But now the worm has turned, and let me just quote Representative Steve King, Republican of Iowa, who was disappointed at the turnaround where now they've reinstated the OCE, saying that the OCE, quote, has damaged or destroyed a lot of political careers in this place, and it has cost members of Congress millions of dollars to defend themselves against anonymous allegations. Is that hyperbole?
I think it is hyperbole. I think that the Office of Congressional Ethics actually, first of all, has done a lot of good in cleaning up some of that mess that you were talking about, that there has been a lot less in terms of scandal over the past 8 years than there was before that, in part because this office has been going in and responding to situations as they've arisen, and things have not gotten, have not been allowed to get to the kind of levels of corruption that were going on before, there have certainly been some cases where there have been allegations and the Office of Congressional Ethics has looked into them and ultimately concluded that there wasn't anything there. And that's what it should do. It should consider allegations. And if there's nothing there, there's nothing there. And that's not necessarily what members want to go through. But if you don't consider the allegations that turn out to be not proven, you're also not going to be considering the ones that turn out to be serious problems. And you know, that's the way any kind of investigative body or ethics body has to work. And you know, members need to come to grips with the fact that people are looking at them and making sure they're behaving properly, and that's as it should be.
Well, when they made these changes, apparently, to strip the powers of this Office of Congressional Ethics, they came up with a replacement regime that I understand was aimed at stopping a repeat of what happened when there was a sit-in in the House, when the Democrats were so frustrated over the inability to even deal with repeated massacres of American citizens by gunmen, the heavily armed. I think it was actually after the nightclub shooting down in Orlando, when they couldn't even get anything on the floor to deal with gun safety. In frustration, they had a sit-in. So that was what I had read last night, that was part of the agenda. So that seemed a little mendacious to me, to get rid of ethics oversight and the independent nature of that Office of Congressional Ethics, and then have a regime that would actually prevent the minority from expressing its political frustration at essentially being shut out.
That's right. And it seemed like there were a couple of things happening, and one was this very serious weakening of ethics regulations. And you know, when you put this office that is currently independent, when you put it under the control of the members, you're back where you were in the Jack Abramoff and Tom DeLay period, where the members are truly policing themselves, and generally that results in little or no action. So you had that going on, and then at the same time, it was loaded up with other provisions, including ones that I think restricted you know, streaming footage and other kinds of things that was involved in that sit-in, and that you know, so it sort of seemed like a doubly cynical ploy, because on the one hand it was limiting ethics enforcement, and on the other hand it seemed to be targeting the political opposition.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, Noah Buchbinder, what's your sense then of whether or not this whole flap has been a kind of gift to Donald Trump, because he has his own ethics problems and divesting himself and not handing his companies over to his kids. And of course, there's an awful lot of criticism of the very nature of the cabinet choices that he's made. It's almost like the cabinet is the kind of Koch brothers' wish list. You put people in charge of the environment who are all slaves to the extractive lumber and coal, gas, and oil interests. And that goes right across the board. So it's not necessarily an issue of ethics to be, I suppose, that upfront, that you're trying to destroy the very purpose of the government departments that you're overseeing. But how would you describe it? If it's not an issue of ethics, it's certainly, you used the word cynicism a minute ago in regard to what they were trying to do in terms of muzzling the Democratic opposition. What word applies here?
Well, I think to begin with, there is, as you said initially, you know, this just massive, there are these massive conflict issues that Donald Trump faces through his unprecedented global businesses that he appears to intend to continue holding. So he's got his own ethics issues from those conflicts. He has brought on board this cabinet that presents lots of its own conflicts of interest issues, that is this collection of millionaires and billionaires and executives who certainly you could argue about whether they'll be acting to promote business interests or the interests of regular people. And then this last issue that you brought up about cabinet officials who seem intent on undermining the purpose of the departments that they're going to be heading. You know, I'm not sure that is an ethics or corruption issue, but it certainly raises questions about what the goals are of this administration. So I do think that in the midst of all this, in the midst of particularly the many ethics and conflicts questions that Donald Trump was facing, he did see this as an opportunity to come down on the right side of an ethics issue, albeit I think a little bit weakly, but nonetheless, to do that and to get some good publicity on ethics issues. I think it was shrewd public affairs on his part. I don't give him tremendous credit, because I think he did it only when he saw the public outrage, and only because he had been subject to a lot of criticism in his own right on these kinds of issues. But I do think he seized the moment and was able to get a fair amount of credit for doing something that didn't impact him greatly, and was kind of going with where the public already was.
Well, Noah Buchbinder, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks so much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Noah Buchbinder, who is Executive Director of CREW, Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington. Previously, he served as Director of the Office of Legislative and Public Affairs at the United States Sentencing Commission and as Chief Counsel for Criminal Justice for the United States Senate Judiciary Committee. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back discussing whether Erdogan is trying to create his own Islamic State in Turkey, while the terrorists of the Islamic State in Syria are attacking him for turning on them. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Natana de Longbas, a professor of theology at Boston College, whose research interests include modern and contemporary Islamic thought and practice. She's currently writing two books, Jihad for Islam, The Struggle for the Future of Saudi Arabia, and Scholars, Stateswomen, Saints, and Seductresses, Restoring Women to Islamic History, and is the deputy editor for Oxford's Islamic Studies Online, the world's largest online database on Islam and the Islamic world. Welcome to Background Briefing, Natana de Longbas.
Thank you so much.
And following this atrocity on New Year's, right on the Bosphorus at a nightclub in Istanbul, just to go back a little bit prior to that, in the Friday sermons that were broadcast across Turkey to more than 80,000 mosques, the Religious Affairs Directorate called the New Year's celebrations illegitimate, and 4 weeks prior to New Year's Eve, ultra-nationalists and Islamic groups were distributing flyers on the streets saying Muslims do not celebrate Christian festivals, etc. So what is the extent of the kind of ironic symmetry here between the AKP, the Erdogan's Islamist ruling party, and the very people that have claimed credit for this atrocity?
It really is very ironic. I don't think that Erdogan was expecting quite the response that was received by this attack that was claimed by ISIS. But there has been growing attention to trying to think about which sorts of celebrations qualify as legitimately Islamic, which ones are really coming in from other locations. New Year's celebration isn't really a Christian celebration either. That would qualify as more of a secular celebration, but it tends to be one that's more associated with the West. And I think it's a reflection of the fact that Turkey is really caught in this unusual place of having been the bridge between East and West for a very long time, and I think trying to reconsider its own identity as to which world it belongs to or wants to belong to and how it wants to identify itself going into the future.
And, of course, adding an extra irony here in terms of the Christmas celebrations, St. Nicholas himself came from Turkey.
Right. So you do end up with this unusual sort of mix that, depending on how you want to define legitimacy, there are different ways in which you could look at the celebrations.
Well, what's particularly disturbing, though, is that following this atrocity on New Year's Day, earlier, obviously, Islamist commentators have appeared on Turkish TV saying, we are against New Year, we are against drinking alcohol and celebrations. Whoever wants to blow up whatever place may do so. So I'm trying to get a sense of the three strains that seem to be at work in Turkey, secularism, nationalism, and Islamism. And they're obviously... There was a secular tradition started by Ataturk that seems to be being eroded, I think, more rapidly than gradually.
It does appear to be the case, I would say, particularly since 2011, when Erdogan won his third election, that there was a real turning point reached at that point. Up until that point, he had been much more about, yes, we can have a religious identity, but we are going to maintain the secular nature of the state. And it seems that since that time, there's been an increasing tendency toward greater Islamization of the state and pushing Islam more into the public sphere, certainly by taking control over more mosques and schools and the imams. The government's currently in control of about 85,000 mosques and 115,000 imams that actually work for the state. So that would seem to introduce a more Islamic character into the government, which prior to 2011, he had avoided doing that in the same way. So he seems to be comfortable enough in his position to feel that he can push this agenda forward. It also seems to be perhaps a reaction to the sense of competition that he feels from the Gulen movement. Gulen, of course, being in exile in Pennsylvania here in the United States since 1999, but nevertheless present in over 160 different countries throughout the world, and certainly very present in Turkey as well. What's interesting with the Gulen movement is that he has not pursued so much of a political agenda as he has an educational one. That is, that he's trying to create this new generation that is educated both in Islamic ethics and in modern sciences. So to produce this new elite, if you will, that would be capable of projecting Turkey even further forward into the future in a way that takes in some of the best of what has come in from Western civilization, but to do it in a way that's faithful to Islamic heritage. And so it's possible that Erdogan is in part responding to that perceived challenge on the ground, even though, as I said, Gulen isn't there. But Turkey's in a very unusual position right now in terms of the number of, or the variety of parties who seem to be attacking this state, for lack of a better word. We certainly have ISIS claiming certain attacks. There was the assassination of the Russian diplomat a few weeks ago in response to the situation in the Syrian civil war. Erdogan has always had an uncomfortable relationship with the military. He just survived an attempted coup back in over the summer. It would not be the first time that the military has attempted a coup in Turkey. So there are many different elements, a lot of unrest that all seems to be coming to a head at the time when Turkey itself, I think, is really struggling in terms of trying to determine what its identity is going to be going into the future.
And again, I'm speaking with Netanya DeLongbas, who's a professor of theology at Boston College, whose research interests include modern and contemporary Islamic thought and practice. She is writing two books, Jihad for Islam, The Struggle for the Future of Saudi Arabia, and Scholars, Stateswomen, Saints, and Seductresses, Restoring Women to Islamic History, and is the deputy editor for Oxford Islamic Studies Online, the world's largest online database on Islam and the Islamic world. Now, you brought up the Gulen movement, and of course, there has been a jihad against Gulen before the failed coup, where Erdogan is simply purging everybody and anybody that might be associated with it. And this is, I think, given what you just, the way you just described the Gulen movement, it does seem to be a very hopeful movement in terms of, you know, countering fundamentalism. I mean, we have fundamentalism here in Christianity here in the United States that has an anti-intellectual bent, teaching creationism instead of evolution, etc., having a sort of creationist parks, I think, somewhere in Kentucky, etc. So,
yes.
and the apparently the new Secretary of Education under Donald Trump is a homeschooler advocate for vouchers and Christian education, Christian in quotes. So we're not entirely unfamiliar with it here. But so my understanding, though, that the split between Gulen and Erdogan came over Gulen's movement detecting corruption in the Erdogan family, and that has led to this extraordinary purging that continues to this day. And by the way, when these professors and judges, etc., get fired, they don't just lose their jobs, they lose their housing, they lose their pensions, they lose everything. This is a level of vindictiveness that is absolutely extraordinary.
It really has been extraordinary. It's actually trickling down even to graduate students who are here in the United States, some of whom have absolutely nothing to do with the Gulen movement, who are losing scholarships and government stipends. I heard a report a few days ago that Turkish officers who are serving with NATO here in the United States have been placed on notice. They have been stripped of their citizenship and advised that if they return home, they'll be imprisoned. And so they are looking to try to figure out how they can apply for refugee status, I believe, here in the United States, because it's simply not safe for them to return home. So this has been a very far-reaching sweep. Part of the irony there is that Erdogan and Gulen, their movements coexisted very peacefully up until December of 2013, when this incident of corruption first ignited. And the real spark behind that was a situation in Gezi Park, that this was a public park known for providing a lot of greenery. It was very popular with environmentalists in the middle of Istanbul, and Erdogan decided to reclaim that public land in order to build a series of shopping malls and high-end apartments on it. And there were serious public protests over this and accusations of police brutality against the citizens who were protesting against us. And Gulen, I guess, stepped out and criticized Erdogan for his actions in this and talked about the need to leave public land in public hands. And that then sparked this sort of tit-for-tat between the two of them, where the government responded by starting to close a number of private schools, about 20% of which were controlled by the Gulen movement. And the supporters of Gulen then responded with this accusation of government corruption. Erdogan then responded to that by claiming that there had actually been some sort of judicial coup that had taken place by Gulen, and decided to shut down the investigation and any kind of media reporting about the corruption scandal. So there was a real fallout that began at that time, and it has just continued. And unfortunately, it's also taking an impact on Turkey itself in terms of the economy, that the financial status of Turkey has taken a serious hit in terms of foreign investments, in terms of its financial rankings, in terms of currency values. And the European Union, which has always been leery about Turkey's application to become a member of the European Union, that has been pretty much indefinitely put on hold on accusations of serious human rights violations. So Turkey has gone from being the sixth largest economy in Europe in 2010 to really being in this state of collapse. They've gone from being sort of the wonder child and the positive experiment in the Middle East that many countries were looking to as a way out of authoritarianism and some of the problems associated with more fundamentalist regimes. And now watching all of that fall apart is having an impact far beyond just Turkey itself, but wondering if any sort of Islamist experiment will ever be able to be successful in the long run.
So much that Erdogan has done, almost you could label him as a sort of one-man wrecking crew, in the sense that he had not only he conducted these purges, and there's no way to justify a military coup, but what appears to be an overreaction to it is pretty extraordinary. But prior to that, of course, in order to increase his executive authority, he revived a war against the Kurds, which has been disastrous. And he was an early advocate to get rid of Assad next door in Syria, and allowed this underground railroad of jihadis to come in. And there, that's the very blowback that he's now suffering. So I'm just wondering, at what point do the people of Turkey wake up? Or is it one of these cases where, you know, the old adage of Samuel Johnson's that patriotism is the last refuge of the scoundrel. In this case, it's both patriotism and religion being the last refuge of the scoundrel, if indeed he is, Erdogan and his family are the kleptocrats, as the Gulen movement allege.
Right. I would imagine that given the serious nature of the purges that have taken place, that there are many in the Turkish public who are simply too afraid to speak out at this point, watching the sheer numbers of teachers who were fired from their jobs, and just the hundreds of thousands of people who've been affected by this, at the same time that Turkey is facing such incredible regional instability and is in such close proximity to the civil war in Syria, and has all of these foreign fighters who are known to have come through Turkey using it as a transit point to move on to the Islamic State or to go and join whatever organization they want to join in the civil war with Syria. You have Iran that is becoming increasingly militant, at least in its rhetoric. So there are a number of regional problems as well as domestic problems that the country is facing. And historically, we've seen that there are times when there's a significant enough threat from the outside that the interior is willing to essentially put up with whatever they have to put up with just to survive. But that tends to be a relatively short-term strategy, usually looking at a maximum of 3 to 5 years.
Well, clearly there'll be more blowback from the Islamic State as they get rolled up in Raqqa and Mosul. And apparently there's already indications that they are sending their cadres out all around the world to create havoc. So presumably Turkey being next door is going to get more than their share of them. But let's just in the last few minutes, though, Tana DeLongbas, talk a little bit about what the Gulen movement's about in terms of Islam itself and what diversity there is in Islam. My sense is that it seemed like a very hopeful idea that Gulen was exhorting his wealthy followers not to build mosques, but to build schools.
That was definitely a very hopeful moment, and something that I think was designed to set them aside from Saudi Arabia, for example, which has focused much more on founding mosques and Quran schools to take their finances instead. This is the Gulen movement, looking at establishing schools that would focus on modern education, particularly scientific and technical education, but including Islamic ethics within that, which is not quite the same thing as teaching by rote memorization, but really trying to think more about the inherent values that Islam is supposed to present. It's been interesting that many of the schools that they have focused on have been in underdeveloped countries. So this hasn't just been a movement about trying to bring about a new generation, a new elite in Turkey, but to make this a more of a global phenomenon, to provide many of these countries with the kinds of technocrats that they need in order to bring them into the 21st century. And because they did that in a way that was not as politicized and certainly not as militant, it was a more comfortable fit. Really, up until 2013, I have not seen much criticism of the Gulen movement. I know here in the United States, they've worked very hard to recognize what I would call everyday heroes. They will host dinners in different locations, recognizing police officers and firefighters, people who are making a difference in local communities, really focusing on the grassroots level. And so rather than trying to build a political empire or take over through the political system, the idea has been much more about building strong communities and educated communities so that the benefits are spread throughout society. One other thing that the Gulen movement has focused on is trying to demonstrate the compatibility between Islam and the market economy. And there have been a number of Islamist groups that have argued against capitalism and held capitalism as responsible for the lack of development in many places or for working hand and fist with authoritarian regimes and allowing them to hold on to major financial resources rather than reinvesting them in the community. And the Gulen movement has tried to demonstrate the ways in which capitalism can work for the public good, particularly by soliciting donations from wealthy business persons, specifically to go into education, so that you're building a future through your youth in a way that is constructive rather than looking toward destruction. And so I think those are some of the reasons why it has been viewed much more benignly here in the West. So many people were actually taken by surprise when Gulen was accused of being behind this military coup over the summer, when there have been issues between Erdogan and the military all along. That dragging Gulen into that really seems very nonsensical to many people.
Well, it does seem a very tragic situation for the country. And, you know, a country particularly, as you say, is at the crossroads between the East and the West. It also now seems to be the crossroads between autocracy and democracy. And one can only hope that democracy prevails. But I'm skeptical that this is not going to end in some kind of social explosion. Just in the last minute, what do you predict?
Unfortunately, I see that it's going to be very difficult for any sort of genuine sense of democracy to survive with the rising levels of censorship and purging that are taking place. We can only hope that the people, as you said, if you have an educated enough public, will decide to stand up in whatever local ways they feel are possible, not necessarily militancy, but to remind themselves and their communities of the importance of the Constitution and the values that they elected Erdogan and his party into power to achieve, and to hold on to the positive achievements and hopefully resolve the issues through elections rather than violence.
Well, Natalia de Longbas, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much.
And again, I've been speaking with Natalia de Longbas, who's a professor of theology at Boston College, whose research interests include modern and contemporary Islamic thought and practice. She's currently writing Jihad for Islam, The Struggle for the Future of Saudi Arabia, and Scholars, Stateswomen, Saints and Seductresses, Restoring Women to Islamic History, and is the deputy editor for Oxford Islamic Studies Online, the world's largest online database on Islam and the Islamic world. We're going to take a brief station break and be back looking into whether liberals risk becoming a permanent minority in America.
God is a concept by which we measure our pain. Yeah. yeah.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Daniel Rogers, a professor emeritus of history at Princeton University and the author of Contested Truths, Keywords in American Politics, Atlantic Crossings, Social Politics in a Progressive Age, and his most recent book, Age of Fracture, won the Bancroft Prize in 2012. And he has an article at The Guardian, Liberals Risk Becoming a Permanent Minority in America. Welcome to Background Briefing, Daniel Rogers.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
And in your article, you say that the recent election was a vote in which anger overrode optimism, and then go on to say the results are that liberalism threatens to become a permanent minority of the educated, the bicoastal, the urban, the non-white, and the poor. So why is it then that the billionaire populist reached out to white working class voters in Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Michigan? And they, of course, are the traditional base of the Democratic Party, and why the Democratic candidate, Hillary Clinton, did not?
Well, I think the question is less whether Hillary Clinton reached out to the Democratic base in those middle western states. She didn't travel as in the same way that he did, but she certainly did reach out. It's how they reached out that really tells something important about what happened in this election. And the difference was, as almost every observer has said, is that Trump felt to those who heard him as if he understood what they were going through in their lives. It's a lot of ventriloquism that went on in that. They would shout things. Trump would shout them back. They had a kind of call and response going on in those rallies. But they felt they were heard. And a lot of observers, this is not my own finding, but a lot of observers take that really seriously, that in this particular election, it wasn't the Republican Party platform that attracted voters. It wasn't Trump's platform, whatever that might be, which is completely up for grabs at this moment, that attracted voters. And it wasn't that Hillary Clinton's program did not have a pull for liberal voters, working class voters, but they voted out of anger, or at least enough of them did, and they voted for the person whom they thought heard that anger.
But do you accept the criticism that Hillary Clinton's defeat, and this has been aired by Bernie Sanders, who certainly, he won 71 of the 72 precincts in Wisconsin, which should have given the Clinton campaign a clue. He says that the curse of the Democratic Party and its loss is to do with identity politics. Do you think that Hillary Clinton's campaign was too tied in with identity politics?
I mean, that's an either-or choice that's going around the Republican Party inner circles, and I'm not a part of that. Mm-hmm. But I think it's a false either-or. Mm-hmm. I didn't title that piece in The Guardian. I don't actually think the Democratic Party is in danger of becoming a permanent minority. But it could be if it doesn't find ways of expanding back to the size that it once was. And where it's got to do its expansion is getting past, as I think of it, this notion that you either must go for identity politics or you must go for pocketbook politics. Any party worth its salt on the left side has got to go for both and should go for both and should have a platform that doesn't make that a straddling operation, but makes both concerned with class issues and concerned with issues of social and racial and cultural marginalization, should make that part of the whole project of justice without having to choose between them.
And again, I'm speaking with Daniel Rogers, who's Professor Emeritus of History at Princeton University and the author of Contested Truths, Keywords in American Politics, Atlantic Crossings, Social Politics in the Progressive Age, and his most recent book, Age of Fracture, won the Bancroft Prize in 2012. And he has an article at The Guardian, Liberals Risk Becoming a Permanent Minority in America. Also in your article, you talk about the 1890s populists, where William Jennings Bryan ran as a Democrat against McKinley, who was shortly assassinated thereafter. And he, of course, outspent the Democrats. I think, I can't remember what the factor was, but it was huge. But in those days, in the 1890s, in terms of populism, Jennings Bryan, of course, famous for the Scopes trial, ran, in effect, on the religious left. And in this election, of course, the religious right voted for Donald Trump, a thrice divorced owner of gambling dens who covets his neighbor's wife and was exposed on videotape of talking about his ability to grope women with impunity. So that's a bit of a paradox. But the way I see it is that that was simply a political deal. The man who wrote The Art of the Deal made a deal with the religious right. We'll take Mike Pence as the vice president and you guys deliver your votes. Is that, how do you see it?
Well, I think it's complicated, but of course you're on to something very, very important. That there's, the Republican Party is made up of really a number of pieces that are glued together without a lot of real solder, but they stay together because they make a deal with each other. And for many people on the religious right, the issue of abortion is the critical issue. It's the one issue they care about when they go to the polls. And they don't approve of Donald Trump as a person, and they don't actually care too much about some of the economic policies that the Republican Party stands for. But if they have to choose which party is likely to give them a Supreme Court that would walk back Roe v. Wade, there's no choice. So they held their noses and voted for Donald Trump. There are others who, for whom the abortion issue is not the key issue, and we saw that in the anti-immigration, anti-immigrant sentiment, the racism that Donald Trump helped to fan in his rallies. They're not going to go vote for liberal candidates because the sort of bring America back to what it used to be when it was whiter and more insular is a Republican Party project. But I don't think that all of the Donald Trump voters are incapable of being brought back into a party that listens to their concerns that have to do with jobs, have to do with wages, has to do with trying to hold their families together with some sort of economic dignity. I think they're ready to hear a message different than the one they got this time around.
So in terms of the religious left of the 1890s, is there a way to revive that? Because, of course, you know, the great social issues of recent history, like ending slavery, for example, were brought about by the religious left. So is there a way for the Democrats, if the Republicans have a big part of their constituency, the religious right, why can't the Democrats have the religious left as a big part of their constituency?
Well, I think they do. And I think we should not sell short at all the amount of energy and the amount of idealism and the amount of just shoe leather that folks in churches on the liberal side of the spectrum are putting into trying to make America into a better, juster, and safer place. It's a really important part of the constituency of liberals in America. But we also know that compared to the 1890s, a lot of the people who would have gone to, say, a socially conscious Baptist church or a socially conscious Methodist church or into the Catholic the proto-Catholic worker movement, they have, in this century, left the churches as formal members. And so part of the challenge I think that liberals have is to figure out or continue to figure out effective ways in which the concerns, the moral, political concerns of these Americans can be mobilized. And there are lots of other ways in which they can be mobilized, but it may not be that the churches will ever play as much of a role on the left as they did once.
And earlier, Daniel Rogers, you said that the Republicans are able to make deals and overcome whatever their particular slice of the ideological pie is and form coalitions and be more effective. what restrains Democrats? I thought one of the reasons was quite simply put, identity politics. You know, I mean, what I find interesting about this Moral Monday movement down in North Carolina, and after all, they've had Tea Party government there for the last 6 years, and we've seen what the results have been, and it may well be we're about to see it start on a national level here with the Republicans. The first thing they're trying to do is get rid of the Independent Ethics Office. So assuming that that's what we're in for, the Moral Monday movement, I think, is a very useful model. And what they say is you've got to leave your baggage at the door. You know, if you're progressive on LGBT rights issues, then don't make a big deal about it. Recognize what all the other things we have in common. Or if you're, you know, a big supporter of Israel, you know, just don't get into arguments about Israel versus Palestine. And the reverse is true for pro-Palestinian people. That I understand is what the Reverend Barber down there is forging. Do you see that as a model?
I do. I wouldn't put it quite that way. I mean, we can't leave anything at the door. We can't leave who we are and how we've been raised and what we care about at the door. But we can actually act politically, which means not coming in with a single issue and walking out if that issue isn't adequately taken care of as far as you're concerned. That's not really political behavior. Not the kind of person that can make any kind of coalition. But what you need is people to work politically together to make the trade-offs and the compromises that have to be made, but also to have an empathetic relationship with each other so that they can see themselves, see some of their grievances, see some of their hopes, some of their ambitions in somebody quite unlike them. And that's something that liberals historically have been good at, much, much better than conservatives.
Well, one of the differences, or at least the way it's been cast, has been that the Republicans are ruthless and the Democrats are gutless, and that's pretty harsh. But one of the things that I don't understand about liberals in this country is that why are they in any way defensive? Because if you look at the sweep of history, all of the great social achievements, like ending slavery that we mentioned a minute ago, was brought about by liberals, the ending of child labor, bringing about of civil rights, of human rights, of women's rights, saving the economy during the Great Depression. And all throughout this period, all the conservatives ever did was say no, no, no. And they continue to this day to say no. They say no to Obamacare, for example. That's what they do. Their mantra is to say no. So my sense is that it's the liberals, at the end of the day, who do all the heavy lifting.
Well, they have done all the heavy lifting in the past. You're absolutely right about that. I think one of the things I mentioned in that piece, which I think many of us believe, is that the conservatives have a very easy story. They think that by saying no, by articulating that inside most everybody that wants to say no, no, no to something or other, they've got a program, and it's going to set everybody free. Well, since it's never really been tried, you don't have to worry about whether it will really set everybody free and make the economy work. It's a storyline. It's a very, very powerful storyline. Free us up, then things will be better. The liberals have a harder storyline to fashion because it's more pointed, it's more practical, it's actually more attuned to the circumstances of real everyday life. But it's harder to articulate. And I think that part of what liberals are going to need to do in the next 2 years, next 4 years, is to reimagine what their story looks like. And that means going to mean doing a little less pragmatic policy forward, think tank forward deliberation, and much more about a narrative. And that narrative might start with, this is the party that, or this is not the party, but it's the movement that freed the slaves. This is the movement that emancipated women. This is the movement that took care of the country at its times of greatest need. And out of that, I think, something bigger than the issues that we saw this time around is going to emerge.
Well, just back to your article at The Guardian, Daniel Rogers, Liberals Risk Becoming a Permanent Minority in America. your argument is also to sort of take a leaf out of Karl Rove's book, where shortly after the massive Obama victory in 2008, 2 years later, the Democrats were caught by surprise by the midterms, and they got wiped out at the state and to some extent local level. And they've been able to gerrymander because it was an important election year in terms of the census. So we got another one of those coming up. But in general, you're arguing that the Democrats should look at regional and state levels, local and state levels in politics.
Absolutely. Rove was brilliant on that, and he made it work. But there's no reason why this is something that only conservatives can do. Like, there's lots of reasons to think the liberals could do this just as well. And that's where I think that keeping, not just keeping one's hopes up in hard times, that wouldn't put it right, but finding new fronts where more victories can be found, more important things can be done, more truly imaginative work can take place, means not abandoning what our senators and congressmen are going to do in Washington. They'll do whatever they can. But recognizing that there are many, many other fronts for politics, and those lie at the state and local level.
But just in the last couple of minutes, given the political realignment now with the trifecta, Trump in the White House, although arguably maybe Pence is running the country, we just don't know the extent to which Trump is engaged. But they've certainly, I'd say, the House is totally lost to the Democrats, and the Senate is their last stand. Would it make sense, therefore, for liberals and supporters, what loosely speaking you'd describe as the American left, to really give as much aid and comfort to the Senate and to push hard for the Senate to make a stand?
Well, again, I'm not a political scientist. I'm an historian, and I think that times when one party has had all three branches of the federal government, it's been very, very difficult for the minority to achieve anything but very sporadic victories there. Not that one shouldn't try. The difference between this moment and any moment that any historian I know can think of is we've never had a presidential figure like this one. And if you want to have a truly optimistic scenario for those on the left, you'll say that Trump will break apart the Republican Party at its across all these rather loosely connected seams. But who knows how? But it's conceivable the Republican Party could find itself in an internal warfare. And if so, then the senators on the Democratic side might have some openings to do some important and interesting things. But as I say, I think if we focus only on Congress, we'll just end up wrongly discouraged.
Well, Daniel Rogers, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
You're very welcome.
And again, I've been speaking with Daniel Rogers, who's Professor Emeritus of History at Princeton University and the author of Contested Truths, Keywords in American Politics, Atlantic Crossing, Social Politics in a Progressive Age. And his most recent book is Age of Fracture, which won the Bancroft Prize in 2012. And he has an article at The Guardian, Liberals Risk Becoming a Permanent Minority in America. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can contact me and scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.